Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. The Ethics Talk team is happy to be joined by Dr. Michael Sandstrom, who heads up the neuroscience department here at CMU. Would you like to say hi?
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate this. This is a really interesting experience.
Yeah, it's not very often we get to have a neuroscientist on the show. So we refer to these things all the time, just citing, you know, Wikipedia or nothing at all. But now we have a bona fide neuroscientist, so you can back us up. We're following our theme of alcohol this week. If you caught last week's show, it was on virtuous partying. If you missed it, you can get the archive at ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Click on Show Archives. You can download it right through iTunes, podcast, what have you. Listen to it while you're running. Whatever. Good show. We'd like to follow that up talking about the neurochemistry behind getting drunk. I hope that's what we're talking about. If not, then I'm in the wrong place.
Well, we can talk about that for sure.
Sure, but just to give you a recap of last week's show, who wants to kick that off?
I guess you're pointing to me.
Yep.
Well, if I could recap. Well, first of all, I want to say that it's a full house in the house. We have Nick Brousseau. You were just listening to Michael Klagstad, Dr. Michael Sandstrom, Sarah Wills, myself, Hope, and Sean Qualls, who's working the board. And so, yeah, I just want to say we're doing these shows in anticipation of spring break, where we anticipate there will be more revelry than normal. Maybe not. Maybe it will be the exact same amount. But last week, we were talking about the theme of virtuous partying. And so is there a way of actually engaging in revelry virtuously and with excellence? It was a pretty interesting show. But among the highlights of that show were some various ways by which one can engage in partying with excellence. And we did come away with the conclusion, I think we were all in agreement, that if you're getting drunk just for the sake of getting drunk, then you are not partying with excellence. So you should not just say, oh, I just want to get wasted for its own sake. And we fear that that is why many people actually drink in college. Why would there be some other reasons for partying? We talked about celebratory reasons, knowing your limit, knowing how much you can drink. We talked about the, what is it, courage, liquid courage?
Sure, social lubricant, I think we said. Some people sort of use alcohol as a way to talk to people they otherwise would not. Mm-hmm. Some of us are shut-ins. I mean, not me, of course, but, you know, a lot of us don't get out that much, so...
Creativity. A lot of people, and this also traverses alcohol and other drugs, because a lot of people, I know Lady Gaga, for instance, smokes pot when she writes her songs. I only know this because I watched 60 Minutes, and in her interview she said that. Smokes pot and drinks whiskey. So some people will do that for the sake of creative activity. So basically, if you have some other goal that's respectable other than just getting drunk, then you're on your way to revelry with excellence. Dr. Sandstrom, you look like you have something on the tip of your tongue. Do you want to add anything to that?
I guess I have that look that makes me seem like I think of something. But, yeah, well, you know, I guess I have this sense that... if there seems to be a need eventually to have either alcohol or some kind of recreational drugs around in order to accomplish having fun and feeling good and not being awkward, then there's sort of a problem, and there's a learning experience involved with, you know, being social that I think people ought to go through. But it is true that there are sometimes parties where the word awkward comes up because you just don't know people. But then, even though it's true that that's the case, I guess I wonder whether the first experience that I want people to see of who I am is me acting like an idiot because I'm out of control, you know?
Perhaps. It's also possible, as this is a position we had a professor argue last week on Ethics Talk, that alcohol is a, you know, it has veridic qualities, or it's a truth serum of sorts, where people get to see the real you the first time, and you get to know them better. I don't know that I want to defend that position myself. Maybe Dr. Smith can come back and discuss that point at a later time.
I'd like to talk to him about that, because I may disagree with that a little bit.
But we certainly did say that, you know, when alcohol becomes a habitual method for accomplishing a feat, that's a bad thing. I think we all agreed with that, right? That alcoholism mode is a very bad idea. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as Hope was saying earlier, I think our main thesis of last week was that using alcohol or consuming alcohol while engaging in some other greater purpose, using it as a means to some other end, may very well be virtuous, and certainly not an end in itself. I think we all agreed with that. Looks like Dr. Sandstrom might not be totally on board with that. But
well, I'm just staring off into space thinking about what you're saying, that's all.
Okay. You can't think of any examples at all where you could virtuously party? Let's say
I think that it's possible to virtuously party. But I guess what I have in mind is that I used to have genuine fun at parties that were set up by my parents, and we, you know, would play games and sort of engage with people and whatnot. But it's true, you know, I knew all those people, and it was easy to do that. But it was real genuine fun, and I always crave that when I try to go to an event or some kind of entertainment thing. And sometimes I feel let down when what it's based on is, you know, here, everybody have some alcohol and loosen up a little bit, because that'll help you, you know. And rather than, you know, here, we're all playing this game, come on, get into it, and then you have genuine fun. So, you know, I toss about that. I go back and forth all the time. But I do think that it's true that you could say very similar things to what you just said about people who do have genuine social problems. There are anxiety disorders. There's depression. And there's a variety of different conditions of the brain where you have, because of a nervous system issue, difficulties. Those are genuine, and people take medications for those to correct those problems. And so the argument could easily be that this is a version of that when we're talking about partying. And I think that's probably where you're going. It makes some sense.
Possibly. And we can certainly virtuously party without alcohol. I mean, Sarah wasn't here last week, but we did discuss, you know, the use of a twister mat.
That is mine.
Yeah, I stole it. I admit it. It's yours. I stole it.
I keep a twister mat in my trunk, and it has come in very handy for when parties kind of futter out, I guess. Like, they are no longer fun, and even if there is alcohol involved, it can't always be fun, so I break out the twister mat. And it sounds kind of stupid at first, but when you get a bunch of slightly drunk people playing twister, it can be a really good time.
And there you have it. There's our PSA for the day. So we'd like to talk about, I mean, perhaps we can discuss last week's show some more, and feel free to drop us an email or something, and we'll try to respond if we can on the show.
3 weeks from now, maybe.
Right. Unfortunately, we can't take calls, but we'd love to get at your questions if we could. That being said, let's talk about what alcohol does to the brain. Now, I'm not sure on the terminology, so feel free to correct me, but as Hope was discussing, you know, the beginnings of this show, she was talking about the reward system in the brain.
Yeah.
Feel free to elaborate.
Well, I guess there's a variety of different things that I could say, but there have been and continue to be different regions of the brain that seem to be what we call hedonic structures, or structures that, when stimulated, tend to give us really good feelings.
Can I just say that hedonic comes from the Greek hedone, which means pleasure. Just had to throw that in there.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, so essentially, the idea sort of originally was that when some of these drugs are taken, and particularly the drugs that have a really strong effect, like heroin and cocaine, that the structures that provide for these kinds of responses are stimulated. And when experimental animals are used, we can actually show that this stimulation is so pleasurable, so gives such a feeling of contentment that it can tend to override a lot of the natural
you know, urges that these animals might have. And so they'll stop eating, they'll stop grooming, they'll stop doing a lot of things that they normally do. And when given an opportunity, they will simply stimulate themselves in that area. And it's sufficient. And they don't sort of feel the need to keep up with the other kinds of things of life. And so there's been this discussion that it's perhaps necessary for those structures to be stimulated in a natural way where we kind of get feedback from when we've accomplished things that actually help us survive. And so those structures probably developed under those contexts. And one of the things that drugs do is they have a tendency to bypass that so that we end up sort of more directly stimulating these areas. And there's another term called dopamine. It's a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical that's produced in the brain that's often associated with these kinds of responses, pleasure responses.
What's a neurotransmitter?
A neurotransmitter. It's a good question. I probably should have mentioned that. It's a chemical that acts as a messenger that allows neurons to communicate with one another and cause each other neurons to have appropriate responses, or in this case, when drugs get involved, perhaps inappropriate responses.
And a neuron is just a brain cell.
A neuron is a brain cell, that's right. And the brain is made up of 100 billion or more brain cells, and they all communicate with each other, and they have these tiny gaps between them. And these tiny gaps allow these chemical communications to pass between them. And chemical communications can either be direct from one neuron to another, or chemical communications can sometimes involve chemicals that sort of flood the system and kind of get in there and stimulate a variety of different neurons at the same time. And it turns out that dopamine, which is among one of these chemicals that has a tendency to flood and go out and stimulate a variety of chemicals at once, has a tendency to sort of interact with the way that a number of other chemicals function, so that when dopamine is present, it creates a very different type of response compared to when dopamine is not present. And when it's working properly, that enhances our attention, it makes us appreciate things that are important, it makes us appreciate times when things are happening that we probably ought to pay attention to because they're going to give us clues about how to survive and find the good things of life. And when it's not working properly, we have problems with those kinds of functions. And so what people have determined, and you'll see this in a lot of textbooks about neuroscience, is that dopamine has a tendency to be somehow connected with a variety of the different drugs that are that have a sort of hedonic effect or a pleasure-inducing effect.
Interesting. Let me rewind, see if I'm following you all the way. And, you know, you're talking about animals and how, given the opportunity to stimulate themselves with cocaine-like chemicals or stimulants, they choose mm-hmm. to do that rather than mm-hmm. eat or drink. So I'm imagining like a large hamster cage with three big red buttons, one for water, one for food, and one for cocaine on an IV drip.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And what I'm picturing is like hamsters just running and just hitting that cocaine drip. No water, no kibbles and bits.
That's right. And they'll often do it to the point where they'll kill themselves because they overdose. And overdose is a big problem with a number of these kinds of drugs. It's even worse with heroin. Heroin is one of the most powerful drugs that have been on the market or on the streets, so to speak. And you can also simulate this by having an electrical connection put directly into the brain at these various structures and allow animals to press a button and have electrical stimulation go into that same region, and the same kind of thing will happen. So there seems to be this kind of interesting connection between the drug and that type of region being stimulated. Now, like you say, that separates the normal function that was used to be associated with that, where you get that kind of good feeling that you've been successful. Well, you've been successful in finding food or having an appropriate social connection or other kinds of things. And that would be very helpful in, you know, getting people to integrate properly and do things the way they ought to. Or you could take drugs and get that feeling. And once again, you're going to lack the learning experience. And think alcohol kind of gets in there because there is this tendency for alcohol to be kind of connected with, you know, a sophistication level.
Sure.
I mean, you know, your parents drink alcohol when they have social events, break out the wine. Mm-hmm. Wine is associated with a number of religious occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have that kind of legitimacy kind of built into it. When you talk about people taking heroin or cocaine, you know, it doesn't really have a tendency to be connected with that same legitimacy.
I just wanted to say, so correct me if this is or an incorrect way of putting what you're saying. So the brain has this reward system, dopamine being a part of it, a special part, because it interacts with other chemicals in a way that other parts of the reward system does not.
Yes.
And yes. That's either good or bad. So if we tap into the dopamine system in the correct way, for reasons that help us flourish, put us on what I would call an upward spiral, that's good. On the other hand, if you start to affect the dopamine system artificially with drugs and alcohol and sort of overburden it and stimulate it in ways, overstimulate it, you're going to perhaps be on a downward spiral. And I just wanted to read a passage once again from, of course, Aristotle.
It's fascinating that Aristotle has so many connections to this world.
I know. Here, this is from the Nicomachean Ethics. And he talks a lot about pleasure and pain. And this is Book 2, Chapter 3. He says, moral excellence is concerned with pleasures and pains. It is on account of the pleasure that we do bad things, and on account of the pain that we abstain from noble ones. And here's, I think, the part that we're really getting at. And he's also quoting Plato for saying something similar. Hence, we ought to have been brought up in a particular way from our very youth, as Plato says, so as both to delight in and be pained by the things that we ought. This is right education. So taking pleasure in the right things and being pained by the right things is what correct education is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, going through that kind of education, life education, you know, it seems like there's something necessary about that. The other thing that what you just said brings up is this idea of the way the brain and the nervous system has a tendency to adapt, to the conditions that it's put into. And it's a good thing that it does. You know, we're around as a species largely because the nervous system has that capacity. But, you know, it's going to naturally do that when you're stimulating it with these kinds of substances. It adapts. It tries to compensate and change its function to adjust itself to those conditions. And when it does that, it actually begins to function in a very different way that's difficult to revert back from after you stop, or if you want to stop taking these kinds of chemicals. And the kinds of compensations and adaptations that take place following some of the more powerful drugs like heroin and cocaine are a lot stronger and more permanent and more difficult to overcome than the ones that take place following marijuana or alcohol. And so there doesn't seem to be as much of a challenge to sort of reverting back. But given the challenges that people from Alcoholics Anonymous talk about all the time for stopping with alcohol, it's pretty powerful.
Okay, so these fallouts you're talking about, would that be like the neurological basis for withdrawals or addiction, these sorts of things?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, withdrawals and addictions would be this sort of tendency to constantly think about, have the only thing that is on your mind be taking more of this drug, whatever it is. And withdrawals would be what happens when you try to stop, and you get these negative feelings and the shakes and everything. And it's sort of what perpetuates the use under conditions when it's a little out of control. And we want to avoid that. But the problem is that it's real difficult to determine how much we need to take before it becomes problematic.
Interesting. And I assume the threshold's different for different brains, different people.
It seems to be the case that, yes, there's different thresholds, but one cannot necessarily look at a brain scan or something and determine, oh, you're going to be able to tolerate a lot more and you're not, which is what the sort of inherent danger is, particularly when people dabble in some of the more potent drugs. Because, you know, you might think that you have a really strong mind and a really strong constitution, but the bubble will be burst.
And if I can shift gears on you a little bit, we're mainly talking about the reward system within the brain right now.
Sure.
Now, I'm aware of other sorts of physical fallouts from heroin and you know, other very potent drugs, things like, you know, cardiac damage, you know, various other bodily systems. I don't know how much you know about all this, but I was just wondering what other physical damage, does alcohol mirror these other drugs in that way? I mean, can there be some, what else happens, I'm guessing, other than the reward system, what else happens from alcohol use?
Well, most of the things that we know about, have a tendency to respond following lots of alcohol use. And so, of course, if you drink in moderation, there have actually been some studies that suggest that it might actually help in keeping your blood vessels clear of cholesterol and these kinds of things. There have been some suggestions that, you know, the tendency for Italians to drink wine associated with meals has some positive effects, but they're certainly not over-drinking. But there's huge liver problems that can occur. The liver is constantly trying to filter the blood from, get all the toxins out, and it can be overburdened, and you can have psoriasis of the liver. And one of the things that tends to happen when you drink a lot is that you tend not to eat very nutritiously. You tend to avoid certain kinds of food groups that would normally be associated with eating. And there's a very clear association between that and lacking vitamin B1 in particular, which is extremely necessary for neurons to survive, particularly those that are involved in memory system. And so there's a syndrome called Korsakoff syndrome that has been connected with alcoholism, where people start to lose their memory and they can't, you know, form long-term memories out of short-term memories, and it becomes a real problem. Of course, once again, this is lots of alcohol for a long period of time. But when people become dependent on those kinds of feelings and responses, or start to learn how to behave under the conditions of having alcohol on board, just like any other drug, the brain adapts to that, and it's feeling more normal when you're drinking alcohol. And that gets to this interesting concept of the brain feeling normal, that, you know, you keep doing things to get your brain to feel normal, and different people have different techniques to do that. Some people jump out of airplanes to get that thrill, to get their brain to feel normal, and other people drink alcohol and things like that, and it's very interesting.
Jump out of airplanes with a parachute.
That's true, yes. Usually a parachute is involved. I should have added that.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that alcohol becomes sort of the status quo for the brain, that, like, having three drinks in my system at any given time is the status quo.
Well, when people become dependent on it, yes. I mean, and that's the distinction that you make. And the argument becomes, when people drink a lot and then you say, you know, okay, you need to do something about this. You've become dependent on it. They might argue with you and say, oh, I can stop drinking anytime I want. What are you talking about? You know, and then, you know, that becomes sort of a debate. And, you know, a person themselves may feel that they have everything under control. But the reality may be that their brain has adapted so that they don't really feel the effects of alcohol. And what that does is that when you want to get a buzz, a high, get drunk, whatever, it'll end up taking more in order to accomplish that because of the brain having adapted. So what happens with a variety of these drugs. And so you build up this tolerance and your brain seeking that balance. And so sometimes you're pushed to continue to drink in order to establish that balance, in order to establish what feels normal for you. Yeah.
Very interesting. You're listening to Dr. Michael Sandstrom from the Neuroscience Department here at CMU talk about the effects of alcohol on the body, most specifically the brain, the reward system, neurons, these sorts of things. If you missed the first part of the show, don't panic. We've got it archived, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Check us out through iTunes anytime.
One of the things I was kind of curious about is how this is distinguished, like alcohol use and these sort of recreational drugs, to the drugs that are prescribed to different individuals. Now, I know there's a myriad of, you know, psychological, I always forget the name of that book that they have that has all the
DSM.
Okay, yeah. So somebody explain again what that acronym stands for.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatric Disorders.
There we go. So we got a gigantic book that says, hey, these are where all, you know, people fall into. They fall into these different categories. And we have, you know, these prescription drugs that we're going to give you that are going to help. Now, my question is like, how does that dependency, is the dependency still the same when you're interacting with drugs that are prescribed to individuals versus this kind of self-medication that we do with alcohol on the weekends to say, hey, I had a rough week, you know, I'm going to hit the sauce for a little while?
That's a great mm-hmm. question. And I think part of the reason why that's a great question is because, in fact, it brings up this idea, once again, of the kind of compensation that takes place in the brain when the brain tries to adapt. And in fact, what people are realizing now is that when the brain doesn't seem as capable of accomplishing the normal feats that it would normally accomplish, so that people feel huge levels of anxiety, people feel depression, people feel even in some cases psychotic tendencies in their ability to deal with reality is a little skewed, and we give medications to try to adjust that those kinds of medications that we give, first of all, most of them actually take a little while of constant taking to actually kick in and have an effect. And it's very interesting to see that as a requirement for the brain to sort of take that in and adjust to it and change its function so that it functions more normally in the context of those drugs. And in fact, what we then say is that we're sort of using the brain's more natural adjustment capacity to help to tweak this brain that's obviously abnormal. And one thing that we know about psychiatry is that, you know, people normally aren't pulled off the street and said, okay, you need to have this drug. They actually go to a psychiatrist because they recognize that they have a certain problem. That adjustment that takes place, that the drug actually changes the way that neurons communicate with each other, actually helps them establish a feeling of normality. And, you know, you do end up needing to take that drug for the rest of your life, typically, which, you know, that brings up another whole question about the strategies that are used with respect to the pharmaceutical companies and whatnot, and, you know, whether or not we want to focus on something that sort of cures versus has people dependent. But you could say the same thing about diabetes and, you know, the insulin that people need to constantly take for that. But I think that we're starting to go off track a little bit here, but the bottom line is that, you know, when people are moving towards, you know, taking a little something to take the edge off or to, you know, help them get through, that should be okay until it becomes to the point where you take that because you feel you have to under normal circumstances. And then it becomes to the point where you're a little bit more dependent on it. And under those circumstances, it's not a directed dependence. It's a sort of indirected dependence. You see what I mean?
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's my personal sentiment, too, that drinking alcohol when you're, like, really upset about something or, you know, you're in this depression mode, that it's not a good thing because it does have the tendency to encourage that sort of dependency, because it's like, okay, every time I'm sad, I'm going to use such and such. And then, I don't know, for me, that just, it doesn't seem authentic when you're trying to deal with something and you use a drug to make that better or something. And this is what concerns me about the psychoactive drugs, though.
Right.
What concerns me about it is not so much a matter of, like, you know, hey, by all means, I'll take a utilitarian argument and say, hey, let's give everybody certain drugs if that makes them feel, you know, normal. Mm-hmm. Then that's fine. You know, that, you know, and I would say that that's okay. But the,
like, well, the question I think that you're getting at is, when can we know that there is some kind of underlying abnormality? You know, I mean, if you start to feel sad more often,
that is, yeah,
you know, then maybe there is some kind of underlying abnormality.
But maybe the human is just abnormal generally.
Well,
I mean, this is what I mean. You look throughout history, we're sadistic. We do terrible things.
If I
we also do great things, but, you know, human itself is abnormal. Maybe we need to deal with that.
I once had a conversation
potential,
with somebody
potential.
Who,
we have the potential for evil and greatness. I just want to say potential, sorry.
Who was suggesting that, you know, oh, come on, everybody gets depressed every once in a while. You know, everybody gets sad every once in a while. So, come on, you know, people who are depressed should just learn how to deal with it and buck up and stuff.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to say that.
And I understand you're not trying to say that, but, you know, the immediate response is that when people are clinically depressed, this is a hugely different phenomenon than when you sort of are sad every now and then. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, there's this complete disconnect between what the actual reality is that people are facing and what they're feeling. You know, they're just constantly feeling down. And there are other conditions where you're constantly feeling up. That's just completely abnormal. And I think we can recognize those scenarios where things kind of veer off into, you know, the quite abnormal circumstances. And then what the deal is that if you start to feel like you could self-medicate and deal with some of the kinds of ups and downs with the drugs that are out there without doing that through a psychiatric, you know, controlled way, most of the drugs that are out there that are like alcohol and cocaine and heroin are going to do a lot more damage than good.
I guess I just want a clarification point. So by abnormal, like I'm thinking like you're looking at the brain chemistry. So certain like levels of chemistry within the brain.
Right.
And so, right, you know, you see like an average amount in such and such area over, you know, a broad number of people, and that's how you identify normal.
Right.
And then abnormal would be like, okay, there's too much chemistry, you know, too much of this kind of chemical existing in this part of the brain.
Right. Right. Like, for example, there's a structure in the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is very connected with the fear response and the fight or flight response and the, oh my God, I got to get out of here response. And if you stimulate that area in a normal individual, then that person will feel fear, will not be able to tell where it comes from, and will probably try to look around and see some explanation for why they're feeling fear. You're looking at me funny. I don't know. But if you do that in experimental animals, then you can cause their hair to stand on end and the cat will and stuff. And when people have anxiety, they have a difficult time suppressing the activity of that structure. That structure is abnormally active, and so there are certain drugs that will help them suppress the activity. But yeah, there's this deviation from the norm that we can recognize oftentimes biologically. But it also is necessary to be able to recognize some of these things psychologically or behaviorally. I mean, another prime example is disorders like attention deficit disorder, where there's been a whole lot of debate about whether or not there's actually physical differences in people's brains, but there seems to be obvious behavioral distinctions among some people that indicate that they have these kinds of disorders. And so whether they're is a physical biological distinction is sometimes sort of a luxury in terms of trying to deal with it clinically. But it is true that when, you know, these kinds of drugs are involved and the alcohol is involved, there seems to be this sort of false sense sometimes that those are actually helping people in a clinical way. Because it's very easy to believe that, you know, I'm much more comfortable when I have this slight buzz, or I feel like I integrate more when I have this slight buzz. And so even when it's not necessarily intentionally taken as this crutch, there's this tendency for it to somehow work its way into your life, I suppose. And I don't know, I guess I'm advocating some care with that.
Isn't there a term, like going back to Nick's question about how we become addicted to other types of drugs to get us back to this base level of normalcy? Is there not a specific term for addiction that's induced by the drug? I think it starts with an I.
A term for addiction that's
induced? Yeah, so it's not the fact that I'm intentionally taking this drug, but rather my body, it's not the will that's the cause of the addiction,
mm-hmm.
but it's the effect, it's the biochemical effect of the drug on my system that creates
the somatic and the...
No, I forget. Anyway, it's not important. But
I'm not entirely sure what you're talking about, but I do think that it is true that at some point along the way, what we're trying to accomplish is to engage the mechanisms that I think we have an internal way, an internal kind of gauging mm-hmm. system where we can tell whether these particular mechanisms are working in some way normally. And, mm-hmm. you know, it may require at some point after an adjustment takes place, more of this drug to feel that way. And we just feel agitated, and it's part of the withdrawal symptoms if we don't have it. And part of the issue is that then we get to the point where we're taking the drug to feel normal, not really to get high. You see?
Yes. Yeah, and I do know that this is a phenomenon, particularly with people who have back surgery, because their pain is so severe that they need to take drugs to just get into some sort of base level where they're just not in excruciating pain. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, becomes, being in that state requires them to be taking this drug.
Mm-hmm.
So I also just wanted to throw in there that this base level of what we're talking about is not just like social awkwardness and the pain that comes from that, but there could also be like physical pain for which you're taking a drug, for which you'll also become addicted and so forth.
Well, what's interesting about that too is that the most powerful drug probably in terms of addiction it's probably fair to say that that's heroin. And heroin, like most opiate drugs, interacts with the pain system. And it takes pain away when you take it. It acts on the same kinds of receptor mechanisms that would be involved, for example, if you're running away from a predator and you get a huge scratch in the back, and it allows you to continue to run and not be completely incapacitated by that huge scratch in the back. I've told people stories in the past about amazing things that people have been able to just completely dismiss, like getting their arm chopped into with an axe and not feeling the pain immediately because of these kinds of responses. And yet, what happens when the brain and the nervous system adapts to taking these drugs that essentially do the same thing is, you know, I like to say it would decide, you know, why should I produce all of these chemicals myself? They're already being given to me, so why should I just continue to do that? And then you're stopping to produce those chemicals, and you stop producing the kinds of receptors as much. And so if you stop taking the drug, then your normal situation is you feel like you're in pain. And those withdrawal symptoms are therefore so much powerful. And you get these huge cold sweats and painful experiences and whatnot. So the assessment of one's own level of pain is distorted when you're no longer in control of being able to produce these chemicals.
And that's interesting, because you mentioned that exact sort of scenario being talked about in AA meetings, like you finally stop drinking after binge drinking for 10 years and you don't feel normal anymore. You feel agitated, you feel uncomfortable, cold mm-hmm. sweats, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it's that state of normalcy that your baseline in your brain has changed?
Yeah, and this is a period that in AA meetings, people often refer to as requiring some sort of spiritual support, some social support in order to get through to the point where you can sort of perhaps regain some more of your body's ability to kind of get you to feel normal in the absence of these medications. And it's hugely challenging for people who are the loved ones or the caretakers of people who have drug and alcohol problems, because, you know, there's this constant pull back towards these drugs, and after one's been addicted, it's even more difficult than before.
All right, we're winding down on time here, but I'm sort of imagining a PBS segment, something like, you know, This Is My Brain on X and X. So see if you can describe it to me. We've got time to go through a few of them, I think. In that sort of PBS setting, describe to me what's happening when I've taken three drinks. You know, I'm at a party, I've been here for an hour, just kind of, as we've said, I'm lubing up for the party. I'm, you know, getting loose. What's happening mm-hmm. in my brain?
Well, alcohol binds with certain receptors in the brain that are mostly associated with inhibition. Inhibiting the brain is important in a variety of different ways, and so there's a certain relaxation, but in the beginning, when you first start taking alcohol, there's a tendency for that inhibition to inhibit what normally sort of locks in the control mechanisms. It inhibits regions, say, in the frontal cortex that are all about deciding, you know, what to do. And sometimes people really kind of get locked into, you know, I shouldn't do that because then they're going to think this and then they're going to think that. Right. And all those kinds of things are kind of inhibited a little bit. And so yeah, you do kind of get a little bit looser. And it hasn't completely nullified the thought process, but it has started to interact to some extent, perhaps, with the thought process.
Would you see that rush of dopamine yet or not yet?
Well, in terms of dopamine, the way that alcohol introduces increases in dopamine is a little bit less clear than a number of the other drugs that have a much more direct effect on the dopamine system. There is some more dopamine that gets involved, and dopamine has a tendency to play a role in a lot of that kind of decision-making process up in the frontal cortex where it gets released. And so those kinds of releases can, you know, give you that kind of feeling like, you know, hey, things are okay, you know. But you're not getting like a huge pleasure feeling like an orgasm. And most people who have drunk a few glasses of alcohol can probably agree with that. You don't necessarily get that. But you do with a dose of heroin or cocaine. Not that I'm advocating it, but I'm just saying, you know, it's a very different phenomenon.
So perhaps it's an independent relationship where because those, you know, awkwardness feelings are turned off, it's easier for me to feel happy or good or loose.
Yeah, perhaps, shots. But, you know, I also like to, you know, discuss this with the philosophical amongst us where we ask ourselves, who are we? Are we the people who make those decisions like, oh, I shouldn't say that, you know, that's not good? Or are we the people who don't care about that? And that's something we have to think about, you know. I mean, who do we want to portray ourselves as? That's this, you know, that's what I keep introducing as this thought process. Now, you know, have I ever drank a beer or two? Yes, I have. But I guess it's one thing to do it, like we've been saying, with the goal to achieve that sort of social lubricant. And it's another to say that, you know, I guess to me, a lot of times it's because I don't want to end up being the guy who's like, no, I don't want to drink. Nobody else should drink. Everybody should just sit here and eat crackers, you know? So, you know, you kind of participate when people are doing things, when in Rome, but you don't necessarily have to go as far as the party animal and, in any event, moving on.
I just want to, you know, connect this with last week's show, because this question about the relationship between drinking and one's identity, I think, is really interesting. And given what Dr. Smith was saying last week, that he doesn't really feel like he knows someone unless he sits down and drinks with them, it seems to be that he's assuming that the true self is the one who is a little bit, you know, loosened up a bit, whereas you're actually taking issue with that, or you're questioning, perhaps.
I am totally taking issue with that.
I think that's a definite future.
I think
show.
It'd be a great discussion. You know, I think the reality is that, you know, let's just think about the weird kinds of scenarios that have come out. I think there was a movie that just recently came out. My sense of recent may not be as up with everyone else, but The Invention of Lying.
Oh, yeah. I say that's recent.
So, you know, the strange scenario of everyone just sort of constantly telling the truth about everything and what we decide to tell the truth about and what we don't decide to tell the truth about. I mean, that's part of who we are. And if we're going to get loosened up and be completely truthful about everything, you know, there's something not you about that almost. I don't know. It's
well,
moving on.
Yeah, I don't want to get in too deep, because we'd at least like to give Dr. Smith a chance to defend himself. And since he's not here, we won't just keep pounding him. But I think we've done a fair job of characterizing the brain state after three drinks. Mm-hmm. So let's move. Let's say, you know, I've just finished a 12-pack, which for me is quite a bit. You know, I'm drunk.
Right. So now the serious sedation comes in. And those of you who know a little bit about the anesthetic phenomenon, when people are given a drug to make them become unconscious so that you can do surgery on them and these kinds of things. Basically, it is that you're suppressing the activity of the brain's cortex. And normally people get completely zonked out when you give them drugs like pentobarbital and stuff like that. And what alcohol is doing is binding to receptors of that are pretty much the same kind of receptors and doing something very similar to that. But it's dangerous because it doesn't do that in the same general way across the brain. But it also kind of creates a sense of stimulation in some regions where we have the feeling like we're completely aware and capable of processing things, but we're not. Our brains are pretty much sedated, and that's why it's so dangerous. Because, you know, people, when you give someone pentobarbital, they're not going to be like, give me the keys, I'm going to go out and drive now, because they're going to be asleep. But in the case of alcohol, you know, you kind of feel like you can still do things. So you're basically, the large majority of your brain is pretty much sedated, and that's why your reaction time is so slow and everything. So yeah, that's the drunken state. And that's why you have to really keep your alcohol level down, and it's important for, you know, police to keep people who are in that way off the street.
And sure, and you're describing this as though I've never heard this before, that somehow it's not that just that we're not self-aware. It's something like, our judgment is affected, but we don't realize it. Like, we don't realize that we're not self-aware. Something like that.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a point in which you can sort of continue to feel like you can make decisions, and yet, you know, to everyone else, the timing is completely off.
Right.
But to you, it seems like things are going the same way, you know, and everything seems sort of still normal enough, and it's okay. I'm not completely incapable of doing it, so I can do it. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why it's more dangerous, because you get kind of bamboozled into this thinking. And then it also, you know, removes the kind of inhibitions we were talking about, where people are a lot more likely to just reveal things about themselves, or even reveal themselves in ways that, you know, they probably wouldn't otherwise do.
Now, I'm not sure how much pun was intended there. So let me just ask, how much of this bamboozling, this you know, lack of self-awareness is affected by regular use? Let's say I do this kind of drinking once a week or twice a week. Does that make it more likely that I'll be more or less aware of my own brain state?
Well, yeah, I think so, because I think when you're doing this more often, your brain is adapting, and your brain will adapt to try to, you know, maintain. And so when your brain adapts, then it makes you feel like, you know, you're more normal under those circumstances. And so you feel like everything is more normal, but you're drunk, you
sure.
know. So... yeah, your judgment's going to be off, but it's even more difficult to determine whether, you know, you really should be driving or whatever.
Right. I think these are all great things to be keeping in mind as we're winding down for spring break and these different brain states. We've got about 3 minutes left. Is there any parting questions people would like to ask Dr. Sandstrom? You look like you have one. Go for it.
It's not a question. It's just a comment that I have as an instructor, and I'm wondering, I guess it is a question, actually. Dr. Sandstrom, do you notice a change, a shift in students after they come back from spring break?
Well, you know, my students are so great, and when they come back, I'm just so lucky to have them, and I'm really happy that they're all back and stuff. But, you know, what I like to advocate is, you know, a good use of your time. And what I kind of hope is that a number of them will be working on their term papers and stuff while they have extra time and they don't have classes and stuff. But, you know, when they do these kinds of things, when any students do these kinds of things and sort of let off steam, I think it's important to be able to let off steam and have some recreation, and Aristotle probably said something about that somewhere too.
Undoubtedly.
But it's also important to do that in such a way where, you know, you're just not damaging yourself. And I think, you know, these days, you know, students sometimes feel that, you know, reading a textbook is aversive. And so if you're hungover and you have all those other kinds of things that come from, you know, having used alcohol or whatever, it's going to be even more aversive. So I hope that their education is paramount, that their, you know, goal is to, you know, learn new things.
Okay, well, I just noticed a change in my students after spring break.
And the look on your face is indicating...
And it's true here, and it was also true in law school, that it was harder for people to get back on the serious wagon, if you will, after being off of it for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's hard for me to get back on the serious wagon when I get back from, you know, being at home for Christmas for a couple of weeks. You know, I have to admit that, you know, and I don't drink while I'm at home for Christmas or anything. It's just, you know, it's like I'm not doing anything. I'm lollygagging, and then I have to be, you know, useful, and I have to get back into that mode. So...
Definitely stuff to keep in mind over spring break. We hope you'd enjoyed our conversation. Been listening to Dr. Michael Sandstrom, the neuroscience department here at CMU, talking to the rest of the Ethics Talk team. Check out our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Have a safe and virtuous spring break. We hope to see you all in a week or so. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're tuned to WMHW HD1 and HD2 Mount Pleasant, Modern Rock 91.5.